You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my webpage at dr-history.com for over 440 true stories of the Old West. Also, now available on Amazon, my first book, a historical fiction based on true events entitled Coal Miner to Cowboy. The story of a young man born in England in 1850. He wants to be a cowboy and makes his way to America, travels from New Orleans to Independence on a steamboat, hires on as a teamster to Santa Fe, then on a cattle drive to Bozeman, Montana. He also rides shotgun on a stagecoach. He travels with a wagon train, and on his two-year journey, he meets some famous people and keeps a journal of his adventures. The book contains a lot of the true stories from my podcast and is now available on Amazon. Visit my webpage for a link to Amazon for the book, Coal Miner to Cowboy.
Now bringing you long distance because he didn't want to mush his huskies through the snow, Dr. History.
Morning, Zeb. Yeah, that road was bad. The sheriffs were, cars were parked there. They were turning people around and sending them a different direction.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. History, yesterday there were spots of it that were absolutely pretty gnarly. Area in specific are you talking about?
Well, I only got about 10 miles out of Burley, so, and the roads were pretty bad in different spots there, so I don't know if they had an accident further on, but they weren't letting people through.
Well, and quite frankly, I'm glad you stayed home. I don't want anything to happen to you and everything. The roads, I know, were bad. The wind was bad, et cetera. Yesterday, I went to Burley, and there were a couple of times that I thought, ooh, a carnival ride. We're having fun.
Right. So today, I'm going to tell you about a guy, and I don't know if you've heard of him. His name is Jack Gilmer.
No.
Okay. In 1841, Jack Gilmer was born in Quincy, Illinois. And this is a guy that was destined to kind of have a stagecoach empire like the West has never seen. And, I didn't know much about this guy, but anyway, he was born in Quincy, Illinois. He grew up as a young boy there in 1855 when he was only 14. His mom died and he thought that his dad would be better off if he didn't have one more mouth to feed, so he took off. So at age 14, he just left. He worked his way down river to the Missouri frontier. He got a job as a mule skinner with a freight wagon leaving for Salt Lake City, and he soon learned that freighting was nothing but hard work, crossing thousands of miles of dusty, rutted trails, and he wasn't real fond of that.
Mm-hmm.
So he started West California, and by then he was no longer just an inexperienced farm boy, but he was, you know, by now he'd done enough to be considered a man. And we don't know much about his stay in California, but eventually he traveled to New Orleans. And by now he's only 16 years old, but he had actually saved $3,000, which in that day and age, man, $3,000. And he probably got it at mining is what they think.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked his way to Independence, Missouri, where he found work as a bullwhacker with a freight outfit hauling army supplies west during the Utah War. In 1857, Jack was hired as a teamster by the freight giant Russell, Majors, and Waddell, making several trips west to Wyoming with their freight wagons. So in the spring of 1859, John Jones and William Russell took over the failing Hockaday and Liggett stage line, and they turned it into the Leavenworth and Pikes Peak Express. And this was the first through Overland stage line to the Pacific. And one of the first stage drivers they hired was this young Jack Gilmer.
Mm.
And he was a man who already knew the trails west as well as anybody. And in later years, there's a guy named Frank Root, one of the pioneer stagers, and he remembered Gilmer as, quote, a live and pushing fellow. As a stage driver, he was one of the best. And again, keep in mind, he's only like 17 years old by now. But Gilmer was well-liked by his employers and was one of the few stage drivers kept on the payroll when Jones and Russell was taken over by Alexander Majors. When Ben Holiday acquired the stage line in 1862, he too kept Gilmer on the payroll as a stage driver on what they called the Dangerous Bitter Creek Division. And it was a good move for Gilmer because it allowed him to live in Salt Lake City, and that was his home. And so by now he's about 22, 24 years old, right in there, 23. But he was promoted to the division superintendent for the Overland Mail Company. And he was in charge of the Bitter Creek Division, the first division east from Salt Lake City. And he'd come a long way from Quincy, Illinois.
Oh, my.
Years before.
Yeah.
So Jack Gilmer was first a stage driver and later a division superintendent on the most dangerous section of the trail during the worst of the Indian uprisings. And dozens of stations were burned and coaches attacked both east and west of his division. But Indian damage along his section of the road was minimal. It didn't happen very much. And his stations and personnel suffered less damage than others adjoining them on either side.
What did he do differently?
Here's what he did. He said that the Indians were more sinned against than they were sinners. In other words, he felt like the Indians were kind of given a raw deal. And he was brave to a fault. He took chances with hostile Indians that few dared to do. He often rode alone into Indian encampments and talked man-to-man with the chief and the braves. They, in turn, respected his cool-headedness and his fairness to them. And he was evidently kind of a large figure of a man, kind of a big guy. But he was able to talk to these various chiefs, and they knew that he meant business. So that's how he kept, the damage to a minimum. Well, this is interesting. He didn't have much control over the passengers who rode his stages. One lady wrote about the Overland Mail stage passengers. Here's what she said, quote, "One great problem was that few passengers knew how to take care of themselves. But Jack Gilmer's drivers were different. At least they kept themselves clean. But the passengers, I hated to see them come into my house. They came in droves, and I had to feed them, and they were so dirty and so helpless." So can you imagine sitting to dinner with some of those guys?
Well, really, when you were in those that era of stage trafficking and going across the West, whatever, hygiene and taking care of yourself, that was a little tough, wasn't it?
Oh, sure. I mean, they went days and days or weeks, the passengers anyway, without being able to take care of themselves. The drivers, however, they were to a home station usually every night, so they could, take a bath and keep themselves cleaned up. So, but anyway, soon after Holiday stages began carrying treasure east from his Idaho and Montana branch lines, outlaws began appearing not long before Gilmer was promoted to division superintendent. And one of the largest up to that time occurred. There were five outlaws, one of them believed to be a woman, actually stopped to coach near the headwaters of Bitter Creek, and there was $40,000 in gold inside the treasure box, and they carried it in the front boot, under the driver's seat,
right,
where they were under his feet there. And there were only two passengers, and they didn't have any guns, so they threw down the box, and the treasure box was made of this, you've seen pictures, the heavy leather bound with a thin iron strap and
right,
secured with a padlock, which only the station agent at the end of the run had a key to. And the outlaws quickly broke into it, and they got away with this heavy load of gold on their horses. And when the stage reached the next station, of course, they sent out a posse, and they never could find their trail. So a year or so later, two outlaws attempted another stage robbery. And during this one, one outlaw was killed and the other was severely wounded. John Hughes was the dead man, and you'll like this, Bronco Jack.
Oh, yeah, good old Bronco.
Bronco Jack was caught and questioned, and he admitted that he and Hughes had been two of the outlaws that had stolen the $40,000 in gold the year before. But he refused to tell what had happened to the loot, except to admit that they hadn't spent very much of it, and he was extradited to California, where he was sentenced to life in prison for an earlier holdup in which some passengers were killed. And to the day he died, Bronco Jack refused to answer any questions about the loot stolen along Bitter Creek, and so it's probably still out there somewhere, hidden.
Well, why didn't they? I was going to ask you this because I was watching an old Western movie here about 4 or 5 days ago. And I mean, this was an old movie, black and white. And I think the star was Tom Maynard. I think it was old time cowboy actor. And on the stagecoach, they didn't put the gold and the currency in a stage box the proper terminology. They put it underneath
strong box.
They put it under the stage, and the bad guys never thought to look there.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. Yeah, that's a good idea. But, you know, not all of the thefts of the Express Mail gold were made by these daytime holdups. During the summer of 1866, there were a couple of thieves that started robbing the overland mail stages in Echo Canyon, east of Salt Lake. And this was on Jack Gilmer's section of the line. And they couldn't figure out what was going on. But when the stage would get to the next station, the express mail was cut open and the mail was gone.
I'll be.
So one day there was a small wagon train camped in Echo Canyon, and one of the wagons stopped with a broken wheel. Well, several men from the wagon train hiked into a nearby canyon, and they hoped to find some hardwood to repair their wagon. And the further they walked, they smelled a little bit of smoke and coming from a campfire. Well, they made their way through an area of large boulders, and to their surprise, they came upon a little fire and a pile of half-burned mail. Empty mail sacks were laying all around, and near the fire, there were two men sound asleep on the ground. Well, realizing that they'd come upon a camp of mail thieves, they quickly disarmed the sleeping men and took them back to town. Well, so the station agent sent a rider to notify Jack Gilmer, who in turn informed John W. Clampett, who was a United States postal inspector who was in Salt Lake City. Well, Clampett hurried to the scene where he took charge of the two thieves, learned how they'd been so successful at robbing the stages. What they did is they worked only at night, and they would lay in wait when the stage stopped at a station to make a change of horses. They would sneak up to the coach in the darkness and get the mail bags. And if there wasn't time to open them there, they would just haul them off and open them later. And they were always careful to rob only those stages where the passengers had left the coach to go into the station so they wouldn't be seen. So they never failed to restrap the boot so no one could tell it had been tampered with, and carrying the stolen mail up the mountain where they would go through it and get what was ever valuable. So kind of a good way to rob a stage without anybody getting hurt, right?
Yeah, really.
So, anyway, Clampett took his prisoner to Salt Lake in a barred wagon, and they were both sentenced to long terms in the territorial prison, and neither would reveal where they had cached the loot from the robbery.
Well, let me ask you.
A few weeks later, one of the thieves was part of a chain gang working on the city streets. When he slipped the heavy ball and chain from his leg, he made a run for freedom. However, he couldn't outrun a bullet. You got to be pretty fast.
Let me ask you a question real quick, Ken. In those days, did people send a lot of cash in envelopes? They didn't have checking accounts, did they?
Right. That's a good question. I'm assuming, like you, that probably a lot of mail did contain cash.
Okay.
I mean, that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, this particular robber got killed. The other outlaw served out his term, but as soon as he got out, he stole a farmer's horse and wagon and started for Echo Canyon. He was caught near Parley's Park and returned to Salt Lake City, where he was sentenced to another long term. And unfortunately, he didn't live to complete that. So there's a cache of, I don't know, cash or maybe some gold, too, that's never been found. That's up there on Echo Canyon.
Oh, my.
So, All you got to do is go find it. And we've talked about finding treasure before, Zeb, and we haven't done that yet.
Well, next week we're going to be broadcasting live and direct from Echo Canyon.
Okay. That sounds good. You bring your horse and I'll bring my four-wheeler.
All right.
So 1866 was kind of an important year for Gilmer. He was doing well, making good pay as a division superintendent for Ben Holliday. In 1866, Ben Holliday unexpectedly sold the Overland Mail Company to Wells Fargo, and Gilmer resigned. He'd already decided to begin staging on his own. So he saw the need for short lines wherever mining camps or farm settlements were being made. So he must have been pretty busy in 1866-7. He located coaches, rounded up horses, buying all the equipment he needed to start these short lines. And he laid out these routes for his new stage line. And the first line extended south from Salt Lake from 150 miles to Fillmore. As soon as stations were established, he pushed it further down to St. George. And the new stage line served nearly every community along the Wasatch Mountains as far south as the Arizona border. Even small, out-of-the-way places where he had these these short stage lines that, you know, the bigger lines like Wells Fargo, they just did the main ones, like, say, from Salt Lake to Boise.
Right.
And from Salt Lake to Boise to California. So they didn't see a need for these short runs.
Well, did they establish, like, on the short runs, how many different way stations did they set up, like, from Salt Lake down to Fillmore, et cetera? I mean, you had to have places to change horses and everything.
Right. He pretty much had to have the same thing as the big lines did.
Okay.
You know, like every 40 miles for a change of horses, and then every probably 120 miles for a home station. So he had the same system set up.
I see.
Had their own stations, and business was good right from the start. He had no competition. Nobody else was doing this. And whenever a new town blossomed, he soon had a branch line to serve it. And like I say, large firms like Wells Fargo, they weren't interested in building these branch-off lines. So locating stage stations among the settlements of Utah was a lot easier than establishing them across, say, the deserts of Wyoming or Nevada. And Gilmer had no difficulty setting up home stations with one of the leading families in each town or at farms and ranches. So home stations were established, like, say, every, 50 or 60 miles, where passengers could rest a while and get a good home-cooked meal. And they only charged 25 cents for a good old family-style meal.
Mm.
But then a guy named Monroe Salisbury joined Jack Gilmer as a partner in his stage line. And Gilmer, who knew how to set up a stage line, he needed someone who knew the ins and outs of the business. So that's where this Monroe Salisbury came into play, because he was a businessman. So, like I said, Gilmer, he was more interested in how to set up the horses, the stations, and the drivers and mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So by late 1867, the new stage company, Gilmer and Salisbury, would grow into the largest transportation company in the West, and listed among the wealthiest companies in the country.
Wow.
And before long, Gilmer and Salisbury would be the largest passenger, mail, express, and freight carriers in the West.
Wow. And it was headquartered out of Salt Lake?
Right. Yeah, that's where he was. And then he'd just head out north and south and east and west and just have these short runs going. And it was very profitable for him.
Well, where was their headquarters? I mean, is the actual building, the office, et cetera, still there?
You know, I don't have information on where that exactly happened. I've got another story I'm going to do the next time we do one that kind of continues on with these guys, Gilmer and Salisbury. So, because there's more to learn about these guys.
Mm-hmm.
I got a book, it's called Throw Down the Box, and it's just all about stages and stagecoaches and robbers and, you know, Wells Fargo and all these guys that had these stagecoaches along the routes. So I've always found that pretty fascinating.
Well, back in the 1860s, like you said, the short routes going from Salt Lake City down to Fillmore, for instance. What was the danger then? Were there a lot of the Ute Indian tribes and others? Were they still on the warpath?
Yeah, there were still various tribes that were, you know, like the Paiutes. The Paiute Indians were really rough on the Pony Express riders. There was a time when they were having an uprising, and I've told the story about some of the Pony Express riders that were attacked by the Paiute Indians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I told you about Pony Bob Haslam that was had an arrow in his arm and another arrow in his cheek, and he still kept going and taking the mail through.
Well, what's the alternative?
Well, you're not going to stop.
That's right.
So, but yeah, I'm sure there were still problems, you know, weather, of course, you know, I mean, look outside right now.
Yeah, really.
Imagine being a stagecoach driver up on a stage trying to get through this wind and storm we're having right now.
Yeah, and this was a 24/7, 365 operation, wasn't it?
Right. Most of them went through the night as well. They had lanterns on each side of the stage.
Holy
so they
cow.
Keep going.
They couldn't pay you enough money to sit up on top of one of those rickety old stages in sub-zero weather, let me tell you.
Oh, man. You know, can you imagine? Like I say, I just driving out to your place today, I'm glad I'm inside an enclosed pickup.
Well, I'm glad I'm here in the studio, and I really don't have any affirmation that I want to leave here. I'm going to stay right here after it's over.
Just stay where you're at.
There you go. Listen, I really appreciate those stories. I love stagecoach stories. They're some of my favorites. And, of course, this man, Dr. History, is heard all over the world, and we appreciate him.